In Franklin County, it was period, mid-70s, there's no real apprehension about the long-term outlook for rent, in terms of stability.
There's not. As a matter of fact, I remember clearly on this, that various American businessmen would come to Iran, would visit me, and would ask about Iranian stability, and my answer was that, if American businessmen are going to do business outside of the United States, that they always run a risk with respect to the stability of the country in which they're going to operate, but that as nearly as one could see at that time, Iran was as stable as most any place else. And this was the consensus, this was the general feeling, both among Iranians and foreigners.
Now, I've read in a book on Iran, the Iranian Revolution, that in 1974, the Israeli representative to Iran, Uri Lubani, predicted the collapse of the regime at some early date.
My reaction to that is as follows. I knew Uri Lubani because he was the sort of unofficial ambassador of Israel in Tehran during the latter period of time that I was there, and I have heard this report. Interestingly enough, that report has been refuted in the following manner. One evening, some years ago, the Israeli ambassador to the United States, Epi Evron, was at my house for dinner. After dinner, he took me aside and said, I imagine you've been concerned about Lubani's statements having predicted the fall of the Shah, and I would like to set that record straight. During the summer of 1978, when I was Director General of the Israeli Foreign Office, I made a visit to Tehran, and I talked with the Foreign Minister Kalatbari and various other officials. They did not seem to be unduly concerned about the riots which had been taking place early in the year. They were more concerned about Russian subversion and things of that kind. He said, at the end of my week's visit there, I sat down with Lubani and I said, now, what about these reports that the Shah may be in some sort of difficulty? And Lubani said to him, well, it may be that there's going to be trouble here, but not for the next 2 years. And Evron said, well, why do you say that? And Lubani said, well, because my predecessor, who had gone back to Israel, had become an Israeli businessman, and had then come back to Iran and was doing business in Iran, that he is coming here these days and is signing contracts for 2 years. So I'm sure that it won't happen for at least 2 years. The importance of this observation being that this individual who had been Lubani's predecessor, and whose name I do not remember, was an Isfahani Jew who had been raised and went to school in Isfahan with several of the cabinet or the ministers of the Shah's government, so that he was as well known and well wired in Iran as any foreigner could conceivably be. It was later that he went to Israel and became an Israeli. So that his sense or and feel for the situation was regarded as important.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In 1975, the Shah abolished political parties and set up a one-party system controlled by the Rastakaz movement, the resurgence group. Resurgence movement, apparently that's the translation. How did the embassy experts react to this development? Do they see it as a positive sign or a negative sign?
Well, there was not much that one could do about it, but whether you agreed with it or didn't agree with it, this was the Shah's decision to go in that direction. The Shah's rationale was that he had had two parties up to that time, and these parties theoretically vied with each other in the national elections. But as the Shah pointed out to me on one or more occasions, the party that always won in the election was the party that had my support. And since that was the case, it seemed rather silly to have two opposing parties. Why didn't we consolidate the whole political apparatus into one party, and then have, since everybody is patriotic and supportive of the Shah and supportive of their country, and then inside that one party, we'll have two wings. We'll have a conservative wing and a liberal wing, and we'll put an able man in charge of each one, and then they will vie inside the party for not only the votes, but the support of everybody belonging to it. And he did appoint two fairly strong characters. One was Hu Xiang Ansari, and the other was Zhang Shida Musinger.
I'm sorry, just trying to this sort of effort to sort of centralize political life further would maybe lead to political dissent or political discontent or dissension.
Well, I think it would have been easy to say at the time that this was not a very sensible move if one was looking at it from the standpoint of a political scientist or a practicing politician. On the other hand, the Shah was extemporizing, there was no doubt about it. And I guess his thought was that maybe this thing could be made to work. But when one looks at the Iranian scene in retrospect, it is quite clear that many Iranians did not like some of the things the Shah was doing, because it made problems for them from the standpoint of their religion, and also from the standpoint of what they believed to be a way of life that was being changed. And I think one of the things that made Westerners, and I'm not talking about just Americans, I'm talking about British, French, Germans, and so forth, somewhat myopic, if you like, about the Iranian scene, was not they didn't have good information about what the Mullahs were thinking and the Bazaaris were thinking and various people were thinking. But it did not occur to them the extent to which there was antipathy to the whole Western lifestyle. In other words, they associated largely with people who rather adopted, Iranians who had adopted the Western lifestyle and enjoyed it and liked it, had been educated outside the country, who spoke these languages, who wore the clothing, who saw that this was perhaps a more emancipated, better way of life. The Shah had done a lot for women's rights. In other words, if you were a Western educated individual, there was a lot to be said for the direction in which the Shah was going. But if you were not, and you were still illiterate and listened to the mullah in the mosque and lived in a remote village in these Zagros Mountains, this whole trend may have seemed to you not only very foreign, but antipathetic. And it has become quite clear since the revolution that a great many Iranians, and I don't know what percentage, there's no point in trying to use figures on this, simply did not like the Western lifestyle and don't want to see it duplicated. And this raises, of course, one of the interesting, most interesting questions about modern-day Iran, and that is, how does Persian culture and Islam fit together? How do you accommodate these two? Right now, Islam would seem to have the upper hand, but there's also a Persian culture of wine and dancing and artistry and so forth that comes counter to the beliefs of the Muslims, and therefore there is bound to be some tension between the two.
Under Kennedy and Johnson, embassy officials, I guess, had fairly routine contacts with figures in the opposition movements like the National Front and so forth. Did this practice continue when you were ambassador? Were there occasional contacts with any junior officials in the embassy?
There were, but the interesting thing about all of that is that whatever your contacts may have been, you would have found that there was something wrong here. In other words, it is good to look at a lot of this in retrospect because it helps to illuminate what was going on at the time. For example, if one had contacts with Sanjabi or Bakhtiar or any of these people Bazargan, who emerged after the Shah left. They didn't know anything at the time. They had interests, they had aspirations, but they were powerless, or relatively powerless. When they came to power, how long did they last? Not very long. They were swept aside, too. And the scholars in the United States, the James Bills, the Martin Zonases, and so forth, they were all of the belief that the National Front would have been the salvation of Iran. Well, sure enough, they got their wish, and it lasted just a matter of weeks. So I don't think this question of having, of digging deep, of talking here, of talking there, would have led an intelligent, clear-sighted person to the conclusion which eventually came about, which was that the Mullahs took this over and made an Islamic Republic out of it.
Right.
And so there was a lot of criticism at the time that I was ambassador from the academics in the United States, that we didn't dig deep enough, that we weren't allied with the right people, that we weren't encouraging the National Front, that we weren't doing this and weren't doing that. When it was all over, they were just as wrong as anybody else, just for a different reason.
But in any case, these are cases, you know, like official the embassy would meet with opposition figures from time to time during this period.
Yes,
what was the Shah's reaction to that? Did he hear about these things, or was he displeased?
These were connections that were usually made socially or without any particular fanfare. How much of the Shah knew about, I don't know. Whenever the Shah confronted me with something that he didn't like, it was usually something that had been well established, that some Iranian had simply gone to the prime minister or something and said, here's what this young man from the embassy said to me. Otherwise, there was no particular criticism, and if the Shah was aware of these things or wasn't aware of them, I don't know. You know, it is a very clear picture as to the extent to which A, SAVAK was well informed about what was going on in the country, and B, whether the chief of SAVAK kept the Shah properly and accurately and adequately informed about what was going on. And this is a very really open question, and I think you get various answers from various people, but my impression was that SAVAK was not nearly as good as it was cracked up to be.
Yeah. In terms of actually keeping tabs of what was going on with the public
sector.
I've got the impression from my reading again that the U.S. intelligence in the 70s, I guess, tend to rely on SAVAK for domestic intelligence information. Is that something that rings true?
Well, I think that probably they did to a certain extent get some information from SAVAK as to what was going on domestically. But actually, the agency's targets and role in Tehran was much more focused on the Soviet Union. You could say that was a mistake, but it should have been focused on domestic affairs inside Iran. But these mistakes are made from time to time, if you like, and the Soviet Union is the prime target of intelligence interest for the United States, and that's all there is to it, and it continues to be to this day. And this one was the hardest target of all, and the hardest one to get information on, and therefore it requires resources be put against it. And when you come down to it in the end, some decisions have to be made of this kind about your priorities in the intelligence business. But it's fine to, because John Smith will say, is interested in Iran, that you should be spending your time reporting fully on Iran, but Iran is not going to damage the national security interest of the United States by a nuclear attack or anything of that kind, and therefore there's just a question of how much money and time you can spend with limited resources.
In terms of when people look at the domestic political situation in Iran, the Soviets, was there any special interest in the activities of the Mullahs or the Ayatollah Khomeini? People know about his
role? Well, people knew about Khomeini because particularly after the Algiers Agreement of 1975, Iranian pilgrims were permitted to visit the holy shrines in Iraq at Karbala and Najaf, and when these tapes began coming back from Khomeini, and one began to get reports of their being played in the mosques and things of this kind, so that as a factor, he was people were aware of him, but that he was going to have the influence he eventually had, obviously they discounted.
Okay. I have a question about the OPEC, oil price increases from 73 and 74. Did Shah ever discuss to you, or discuss with you, or explain to you his sort of philosophy about the role of oil, petroleum, and Iranian economic product?
Well, yes, various discussions, but I think a coherent description would be to say that for years, starting at least at the time of the 53 nationalization by Mossadegh and the Anglo-Iranian oil company, that the Shah was desperately trying to get a little bit more money for the oil he was selling, and the oil companies were being very tough with him. He couldn't even get a half a cent a barrel raise. And for years, he smarted under this. He thought they were being grossly unfair, and he was having a tough time upgrading the living standards of his population, and this was the only real asset he had, was this oil. So when the time came that there was a possibility of getting increased prices for oil, he obviously was in the vanguard of those trying to get them. There was no doubt about this. And when one looks back historically, it was fine for the United States, or the West if you like, to complain about the sharp rise in oil prices at the time. But if they ever look back historically at the way they treated the Shah and various others in that part of the world, I think a fair-minded person would say that there was a lot to be said on both sides of this question. And governments shy off these things by simply saying, well, this was business, that these were oil companies, and they ran their business the way they wanted to, and they couldn't be controlled by the governments, and so forth. Well, I want to tell you that the Shah used this against the West when the time for the oil price rises came, because on one occasion, he didn't shake his finger at me, but he looked me right in the eye and he said, now I hope that you're not going to try to get the United States government involved in this question of oil prices. After all, we have dealt for years with these companies, that's the way your government has told us that we have to do it. They have not been very forthcoming, but I want to deal with the oil companies now as I have in the past, and I don't think it was proper for you to intrude into this as a representative of the United States government. And that was a position he consistently held.
I suppose about the oil being oil embargo, the boycott of Israel and the U.S. I guess apparently after 67 oil boycott.
As
a 67 boycott of Israel, the oil boycott?
When it's the 67 war, the 67 war, the 67 war, there was no boycott in 67, it was in the 70s.
I mean, there was a temporary oil embargo next to Israel, wasn't there? Or the OPEC laws.
That war only lasted 6 days, yeah. So I mean it wouldn't have, they could hardly have put a boycott into effect in 6 days.
So unfortunately Iran did not participate in it.
Well, it was the 73 oil boycott that OPEC brought against Israel, and Iran did not participate in that boycott. That was the only one I'm aware of.
I thought there was a 57.
Sure. Well, I think you'll find that there was now, probably. But in any event, in 73, OPEC did boycott Israel, and the Shah said, no, I sell my oil, as I have always sold my oil, and anybody that wants to buy it and can pick it up and take it out of here is welcome to do so. And I declined to get involved in any effort of this kind. And I remember that after the war was over, Kissinger came to Tehran on a visit in an effort to get the Shah's help in ending this boycott. And the Shah was obliging. He sent his top oil man, the man who represented him on OPEC, Jamshid Musagar, to Jeddah, sort of Riyadh, I guess, with a special message to, I guess it was King Khalid at that time, and he also sent a particular message to the Egyptians, to Sadat, to whom he was very friendly, asking him also to
end the boycott. So the Shah was cooperative with the United States in trying to end this boycott of Israel.
Yeah, under the impression during the embargo itself, Iran did not raise its production of oil to offset the effect of the impact of the oil embargo.
This I just got, I don't know about what the figures show.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I can't get involved in that. I don't know.
Sure, okay. But during the embargo, the OPEC countries made dramatic increases in posted prices. November, December, I think. The Shah was in the vanguard of this movement, as you said.
It was in December that they finally jacked them up.
What was the U.S. diplomatic response at that point?
The diplomatic response was to try to bring pressure to bear on the Shah not to raise the prices. This is what the State Department was trying to do. But the Shah simply ignored the request.
Did you bring this up with some discussions?
Well, I was involved in delivering these messages to the Shah, but he was having none of that. He said, I've tried in the past to get price rises, and the American companies wouldn't give them to me. Now I've got them, and you're going to pay.
Well, why do you think the Shah was so insistent upon huge price increases? Do you have particular objectives in mind?
Yes, he had very clear objectives in mind. One, he wanted to bring his country into the 20th century. Two, he wanted to industrialize it. Three, he wanted to buy arms for his armed forces. Four, he wanted to raise the standard of living of his people. In short, he wanted this money for various purposes, which he had had in mind for years about his country and which he would like to want to see happen in his lifetime. In other words, he would say that he wanted to bring Iran up to the living standard of Western European countries in 10 years or 20 years, or I forgot the exact figure he used. It was a praiseworthy aim, but manifestly impossible to fulfill.
Those objectives, did he have any particular priority? Like, did arms sales, arms purchases have the biggest priority in his mind, or was it they all pretty equal, from your impressions?
I think that they were all pretty equal. What he wanted was enough money so that he could do the things that he wanted to do, and I don't think he spent a great deal of his time saying, I get this for that and this for that. I think he wanted enough so he could do all of these things at the same time. And he was able to in the end.
Sure. For this period, in the Nixon administration, was there any discussion in any administration that you heard about of efforts to find ways to induce the Shah to roll back prices or to change his policy to restrain him in OPEC in some way?
Well, I mean, it wasn't just the Shah, it was the Saudis and the whole OPEC cartel, so that they had several. After all, the biggest producer was Saudi Arabia. And I know that Ambassador Akins, who was there at the time, attempts to make a case for the fact that the Saudis were restrained in these matters, but I've never seen the evidence to support this contention. In other words, the Saudis would blame the Shah, and the Shah would blame the Saudis, and it would go back and forth, but the fact remains they all profited from it.
Apparently William Simon proposed at this time that the U.S. uses control over arms sales as a means to induce the Shah to try to get him to change OPEC policy in some way.
I don't know whether Simon advocated that or not. I know that Simon was not one of the Shah's favorites because he made some disparaging references to him, and this was when he was Secretary of the Treasury. And this was rather difficult for an ambassador to handle, disparaging references. But aside from that, I have no doubt that Simon had various ideas. But carrying out those pressure tactics, I think, would have been a very poor idea from the standpoint of the U.S. position, not only because of the 72 decisions that were made by President Nixon about the Shah's role in the Persian Gulf, but if the United States had clamped down on arms sales, the Shah would have been confronted with the necessity of buying them elsewhere. And there seems to be a myth in this country that we're the only people who sell arms. I mean, the French sell them, and they're glad to, and the British, and the Germans, and the Italians, and the Russians, and Lord knows who all. So it is possible to buy arms without the United States. And we become, as a country, a little bit myopic from time to time with the feeling that nobody can live without us. Well, that isn't true.
In fall of 73, I guess, Kissinger met with the Shah. to discuss international economic implications of petroleum price increases? I guess he went to Tehran and talked about these things with the Shah. Do you recall that visit?
Yes, I recall the visit, certainly.
Were you present at the
meeting? I was present.
What was the upshot of the discussions? What did Kissinger say?
Well, I think it was quite clear that Kissinger was going to get nowhere with this argument and didn't get anywhere with it. And he didn't allow it to become a big bone of contention with the Shah. It was handled with some decorousness and so forth, and in such a manner that Kissinger didn't hit Shah too hard, and Shah didn't hit Kissinger too hard, but it didn't get anywhere. I mean, it didn't accomplish anything.
Okay. Now, apparently, with the enormous increase of petroleum income, the Shah in 74 doubled the Iranian investment program. Or nearly double it.
Those figures you'd have to get.
But there were substantial increases, I mean, in investment costs.
Oh, I think there were, yes, no doubt about it.
Was there any concern about the economic effect of those decisions, whether it might lead to inflation or shortages and so forth? And,
well, I think the Shah himself was aware of the implications of those decisions. And one of the things that they attempted to do in handling this was to try and avoid having too much of an inflationary effect. Over time, they didn't succeed very well, but they at least were well aware of the problem and were trying hard.
Were they concerned the embassy that might get out of hand in terms of the effect on living standards and so forth?
Well, I think that the embassy was certainly concerned about it. I don't know whether you intend to talk to other people that were there at the time, but William Liefeld, who is over here, represented General Electric, was the economic counselor at the time, would know very precisely about those things.
Some questions about, I guess, Iran in the regional context this time, the 70s. Did the Shah discuss with you his broad foreign policy goals in the region, in the Near Eastern region?
Yes, I mean, we discussed this on various occasions, and the Shah's foreign policy goals in the region could be described by one word, stability. He said, I can't possibly improve the living standards of my people, industrialize this country, modernize it, without stability. It's out of the question, so I've got to have stability. And he systematically went about the job of seeing to it that he had a friendly or at least a working relationship with every country around him. It started with India, where he went to a lot of trouble to make favorable oil sale deals to Indians in exchange for iron and things of this kind. He had a very good relationship with Bhutto in Pakistan and worked with him in a variety of ways, including trying to help Pakistan improve its economy. He tried hard with the Afghanis to work out an arrangement on the Helmand River, which had been with the waters of the Helmand, how they were going to be divided had been a bone of contention for years. And he finally effectively settled that matter with the Afghani government. He also offered them loans and so forth. Well, the Afghanis didn't necessarily accept offers that he was making to them, but it was abundantly clear that he intended to get along with them, that he did not intend to have an exacerbated situation there which had existed before. With the Soviet Union, he had trade. He was very scrupulous about abiding by any arrangements or treaties he had with the Soviet Union. You will recall that the sturgeon catch and the disposal of caviar and so forth was supposed to be 50-50 between Iran and the Soviet Union. He abided by this to the letter. He had an agreement on hijacking with the Soviet Union. One time when I was there, some Russian pilot flew a small plane across the border and landed in northern Iran. And since under the treaty he was to return the pilot, he turned right around and sent him right back to the Soviet Union. So the Shah was very punctilious in all his arrangements with the Russians. And I remember he had them build a steel factory in Isfahan. And at the time that he was going to open the steel factory, he notified the Russians that they would have the ribbon cutting or whatever the affair was, and would they send some high-level representative? Well, the Russians didn't send a high-level representative, at least they indicated they would not do so. And the Shah was very disappointed in this. Well, then within 48 hours of the ceremony, it was announced that Kosygin was going to come and participate. So the Shah was obviously pleased by that, but he also thought it was a time to make a point with the Russians. So two Iranian army officers who had been caught spying for the Russians who were in jail were shot at dawn on the day that Kosygin arrived in Iran. He thought this would give an appropriate message to the Russians that he didn't intend to be put upon by them. But everything was correct otherwise. As far as Iraq was concerned, he not only worked out the Algiers Agreement of 1975, which was very important to him, actually, but and I can come to that on another occasion if you want to describe that, but he went to some trouble to arrange for the pilgrims to go back and forth to the holy shrines in Iraq, and he got a modus vivendi going with Saddam Hussein, who became more and more important with each passing year. As far as the Gulf states were concerned, Kuwait was deeply concerned that the Iraqis might grab part of its little country, so the Shah would support the ruler of Kuwait. The Shah and King Faisal were, and King Khalid as well, were friendly, but they were like ships passing in the night. They really did not thoroughly understand each other. The Saudis were always concerned that the Iranians might make some move against them. But the Shah never did, and his handling of those three islands and the plebiscite in Bahrain and all of these things were designed to stabilize and pacify the area, even if he lost a little something in the process. So you can see that he, as a geopolitician, was very calculating about all these things, and he really had no enemies in the real sense around him.
Triple stakes.
Yes, during this period before he left his country. Now, the Algiers Agreement of 75, the Shah regarded as important for this reason. He felt that his father had made two treaties during his time as Shah that were demeaning to the sovereignty of the country. One was the permitting the British to run Iranian oil. And the second was the treaty that he made in 1938, I believe it was, with Iraq, about the border between Iran and Iraq at the Shatt al-Arab. And as he used to put it, he said the demeaning quality of that arrangement that my father made about the sale of putting the oil in the hands of a British company was done away with by nationalization during the days of Mossadegh, so that was, balance was addressed. But I wanted to address this question of the border between the two countries, which the English are responsible for having given us an unfavorable treaty. So this was why in 1975 he agreed or encouraged Saddam Hussein, under the cover of an OPEC meeting in Algiers, to sit down for 2 days, during which they finally worked out what became known as the Algiers Agreement. The first day, as I understand it, they got nowhere. The second day, they finally very quickly made the arrangements that finally eventuated from this. I will put in the parenthesis here for the record to say that I once asked the Shah later on how the conversations had been conducted, because there were only three people in the room for these 2 days. There was Saddam Hussein representing Iraq, there was the Shah representing Iran, and there was Boumediene as the moderator.
And the Shah said with a smile that he spoke French to Boumediene. Boumediene spoke Arabic to Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein spoke Arabic back to Boumediene. Boumediene spoke French back to the Shah. This was the way this whole thing was worked out.
As a result, the border between Iran and Iraq was moved back to the Taravag, which the Shah considered to be the reasonable arrangement, because that is the border usually, where there's a riverine problem, and usually the Taravag is the borderline between two countries on either side of that river, or that body of water, whatever the case may be. So it was agreed that as a Shah al-Arab, the border would be moved back to the Taravag. The negotiations would go on between the two sides about the land border on up from there, that they would put a joint committee together to work that out in a proper fashion. The Shah agreed to withdraw his support for the Kurds, and Saddam Hussein agreed to open the border to pilgrims, and there were some other things that were worked out in greater detail as time went on. The fact of the matter remains, and very interestingly, both the Shah and Saddam Hussein stuck to the letter of this agreement, and while the Shah was in Iran, there was never any problem about it. All the problems came later.
Apparently, the agreement was made in 75, wasn't it? 75, yes, yes. Apparently, in terms of the Kurdish question, the support for the Kurds in Iraq, I read somewhere that the Iranian troops passed the Iraq border and efforts to get military support to the Kurds.
Well, I don't think that's true.
That was not true.
I don't know. Yeah. I never heard that.
Yeah.
The one thing I do know is that the Iranians use 105mm guns to shell Iraqi troops confronting the Kurds, so they shoot over the hills. And so I believe the Iraqis had very considerable military losses as a result of the shelling. They were terribly anxious to have it stopped. And this is why Saddam made the deal.
There was a fear of war.
It wasn't a fear of war.
Yeah.
It was as he was losing soldiers by the firing of these guns that nobody was admitting was taking place.
Were there any U.S. personnel involved in this whole effort to support the Kurds? Any, rookie in Iraq or...
I don't know. I just know that the countries that I mentioned earlier were all supplying materiel of one kind or another, support of one kind or another.
Yeah.
But whether any of their nationals ever got up to the border areas, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
Yeah. Yeah. What happened to the Kurds? Were involved in this effort. The U.S. was getting support for them.
Well, Barzani, who was the principal Kurd, Kurdish leader, later came to the United States and died here of cancer. I think his two sons, Masoud, and I've forgotten the name of the other one, are still involved in Kurdish affairs, either in Iran or Iraq, I forget which. I think that's about enough.
I'll turn it off for a second.
I think the last thing I want to mention here today is that if you're trying to get a picture of what was going on in Iran during this period, you should take advantage of the fact that Iranian officials are located physically in the United States and are easy to get at. For example, General Hassan Tufanian lives right here in this area, and he knows more about weapons procurement and why the Iranians bought this weapon system versus that system than any other living person. And I would strongly suggest that somebody sit down with him and give him a chance to present his side of the story. He's dying to talk to people. I could arrange an interview, I'm sure, if it was done on a scholarly basis as you're doing it. And I would think that whoever is running this project would be very interested to have that kind of information. I don't think he's ever talked to anybody about all these things. The relations with Israel, with Iran, and with Israel is a very interesting story in itself.
Okay.